would have gotten away with it too if it wasn't for those meddling devil's advocates.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, a whopper of a Wednesday. We got a fine guest right now live via Zoom. He's our good friend, former U.S. Attorney James Santel. We welcome back Jim. Jim, thanks for coming, man.
Mike and Dom, good to be with you once again.
Well, thanks, Jim. Obviously, the Derek Chauvin verdict has dominated our conversations and the airwaves and everything else last 24 hours. A fairly quick verdict, guilty, guilty, guilty. What was your first take on the verdict, Jim?
First of all, appropriate. We talked before about this menu of options before this jury. They selected all of them, which is appropriate based upon what was presented and what was before them in the law. Plainly, the fact that they spent 10 hours deliberating suggests that they were serious about what they were doing. It was not an overly quick verdict, but it wasn't elongated either. So appropriate there. Plainly, there will be an appeal. I would anticipate those kinds of things that the judge raised, others raised, defense counsel raised, could be the subject of appellate proceedings, but nothing there indicating that there is something substantially wrong with the trial that was suggested an appeals court would overturn this. So we look forward to the sentencing hearing in about 8 weeks. The judge directed a PSI, a pre-sentence investigation report, be done, and then also anticipated a bit some of the things that are going to be happening under the sentencing guidelines in Minnesota. Plainly, those are going to have a big impact on what the judge does and the kind of sentence that Derek Chauvin receives.
Now, we had the verdict live, but I didn't realize in real time that the defendant was taken into custody immediately after the hearing. Jim, is that typical procedure in a capital case like this?
Not at all unusual. Perhaps a bit surprising that Judge Cahill has been wonderful in this case in terms of giving balance, direction to everybody. I did not ask for any response by the defense counsel, but indicates again that the normalcy of that proceeding. This is a defendant who is no longer presumed innocent. The jury has come back and said you are guilty of three serious felonies, including a second degree unintentional murder here. Under those circumstances, appropriate to remand the defendant. Not at all surprising in a situation like this. If you had a white collar case, if you had a situation where you did not have this sort of aggravated circumstance that you do have here, the judge might have given some consideration to keeping the defendant out of custody, but here entirely appropriate, not a bit surprising. And of course, those images now seared in all of our minds of Derek Chauvin now being handcuffed himself and taken away from prison, probably for the substantial period of the rest of his life.
James Santel, our fine guest, former U.S. attorney, wanted to talk about the dynamic of the jury. The jury, my understanding, were about six white and six non-white, and the jurors may remain anonymous forever, as far as I can tell, for their own protection. But the ethnic makeup of the jury, do you think that affected the outcome of this trial, Jim?
Again, I looked at Judge Cahill, who did a meticulous job of doing what we call voir dire, that is looking at the panel of all the jurors who are brought in. You may recall that he dismissed some possible jurors early on based upon the possibility that they may have been tainted by some pretrial publicity on this. He addressed the issue again during the course of the proceedings itself. He plainly selected a jury of peers. And so once again, when we speak about appellate issues, it's going to be difficult for this defendant to look and say, you know what, I was not given a jury, a panel of peers. This is a panel that was representative of the local community of America, I would offer, not only in terms of its racial composition, gender composition. It plainly is the kind of thing that we would anticipate in a decent, good trial of them on the merits of the case. Lots of different diversity there and a good reason to be justified in the legitimacy of the verdict that they did in fact return.
Jim, regarding a potential appeal, Maxine Waters made some comments. Joe Biden made some comments. I saw that Ted Cruz thinks this is now a reason to maybe nullify this. What's your take on that? Of course, the change of venue also was denied initially. Do you think any of those things will get any traction?
Sure. Once again, will they be raised? Almost certainly. You're going to hear those in the course of an appellate proceeding before the Minnesota Appeals Court. Likely to succeed? No. Once again, because Judge Cahill was so good about addressing those issues. He expressed his frustration playing with the Congresswoman as she was saying that, and that's a significant message to be sent, but nothing there that I see as being a subject for overturning this verdict, sending it back for a new trial. This is a tight record. This is a complete record. Judge Cahill has done a very good job of battening down all those.
Jim, in the decade we've done this fine program, I think this is our first live verdict. And before it dropped, Dominic and I argued a bit about an elected official commenting on the outcome of a trial that's still at jury. Wanted to get your assessment, counselor, of how appropriate that would be. I didn't like it when Joe Biden did it. Obviously, the jury was sequestered at that point. But, I mean, he's the president of the United States. Maxine Waters, a slightly differing circumstance. But, Jim, all in all, should they be doing such a thing?
The simple answer is no. In part because it does give a defendant an appellate issue, again, even one that's not compelling. Second, you recall all the conversations we have had during the course of the past several years about the impropriety of executive branch people. I would offer legislative folks also commenting on pending cases. We criticized the former president wildly for that, right? The same should apply across the board, whoever is in the White House, whoever is in the legislature. These are the kinds of things that elected officials can comment about generally, talk about the need for police reform, talk about the interest in safety and security, talk about the interests of getting good officers there and the protecting our society, our community, all those broad issues. But the reality is that they shouldn't be commenting on the merits of the case.
Well, I'll accept Dominic's apologies off air.
Oh, well, Jim, now I'm going to have to put it to you like I put it to Crudy then. Would it be appropriate for Congresswoman Maxine Waters to comment on Loving versus Virginia, for example? Or voting rights laws, civil rights laws, lots of different court cases going on that absolutely people have a right and I would consider an honor or duty to comment on if they feel so inclined to do so. Now, the jury not allowed to look at media. The jury sequestered during Joe Biden's statements. I look at it as in some regards, in this sense, as a leadership position to offer your opinion on this case. Now, you know, I'm not a big prayer guy, but Joe Biden didn't say he prayed for conviction. He said he prayed for the right outcome. But if you don't think politicians should be commenting on these kinds of cases, then where's the breakdown? What cases are appropriate to comment on then?
Sure. And again, I think we draw a line chronologically, too. When a case is pending before a decider of fact, that's when I think it's more problematic. Afterwards, if things are all resolved, then you can comment. And so Loving versus Virginia, Brown versus Board of Education, Roe versus Wade, all those kinds of things, right? Settled law, appropriate to comment.
Are we sure they're all settled, Jim?
Yeah, that's right. So if this comes up again, knowing how the conservatives are, you're suggesting that perhaps Biden shouldn't let his thoughts be known about Roe v. Wade?
Not at all. No, because they are settled law, his advocacy should be in favor of continuing with what the law is. My concern is that when elected officials are commenting about something that is pending in the moment, that's before either a grand jury, a trial jury, that could have an impact upon the result itself. Before the Supreme Court, those kinds of things. Now, you do have a Solicitor General who plainly is a part of the Department of Justice, takes a position. But again, that's advocacy inside the trial setting itself, inside the appellate setting itself. You don't have someone on the outside. Beyond that, however, again, the important issue is the broad topics, environmental issues, tax issues, antitrust issues, all those kinds of things, broadly speaking, absolutely legislators and executive officials should comment upon. It's the specific cases, you know, it's those kinds of things under the Barr administration that we bemoaned the fact that a president was commenting about a reduction in sentence or things that should happen there. Those are matters for the courts to take care of. Afterwards, I have no problem with presidents, legislators commenting about those things. They shouldn't have an impact. The question whether or not the president spoke about praying for a just verdict, I don't know if that crosses the line. I think that's sufficiently innocuous to fall under appropriate commentary by a president, not just because I'm attracted to his presidency, but because I think that's fair. He wasn't asking a jury to come back with a particular verdict as to the second charge, the third charge. He wasn't commenting on the specific testimony. He was asking for a fair and just verdict. I would argue that that's probably on the side of propriety. things beyond that go become more problematic.
Well, then I'll expect Crudy's apology off air.
Jim, I feel like the counselor's backtracking. I'd like to treat him like a hostile witness.
Denied. James Santel, former U.S. attorney, our fine guest. The sentencing. Did the math yesterday between the three convictions, 75 years. But then it was like, well, is this going to be concurrent or consecutive, counselor? How do you think this plays out? And how much leeway does the judge literally have in this case?
Right. Great question. Lots of things are to be before us in about 8 weeks or so. So you recall that at the end of the proceedings, just before Derek Chauvin was remanded to custody, the judge looked at him and his attorney and said, do you make your Blakely waiver? And everyone said, what's that all about? Well, basically, it says that the defendant has waived the right to get a determination by the jury about aggravating factors, and it gets back to the sentencing guidelines in Minnesota. So, yes, you've got those statutory maximums, 40 years, 25 years, 10 years. Highly unlikely that this judge is going to be imposing a sentence at or anywhere near that, because the other piece of this is the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. And for charges like this, convictions like this, generally probably somewhere between 10 and 15 years, maybe 12 and a half years is where you begin. And the Blakely issue comes in, and the judge, based upon the sentencing guidelines, can in fact enhance that, could go higher than that, if there are circumstances that warrant that. So for example, that Chauvin killed Floyd in front of children, that would be one exacerbating circumstance, that he acted with particular cruelty, that he abused his position of authority as a law enforcement officer. Based upon all those kinds of things, the judge here, Judge Cahill, could say, you know what, I'm bound by the sentencing guidelines, but I'm going to increase, whether it's inside or even beyond the sentencing guidelines, based upon these aggravating factors. And so it wouldn't be surprising if Derek Chauvin gets a sentence well beyond 12 and a half years, could be 15, could be higher than that, depending upon how the calculation comes out. Again, it's this interplay between the statutory maximums, which you've added up accurately, Dom, and the sentencing guidelines, which also have a big impact upon what Judge Cahill will do here in about 2 months.
Would some of those factors be the 15 or 18 complaints that have been lodged against the officer in the past?
You certainly, and again, part of the pre-sentence investigation will certainly include those. He also ordered a PSI. And again, everyone said, what is a PSI? It's basically a pre-sentence investigation directing that an organization put together a history of who this defendant is. That will be included in there, what his history of employment record has been, family issues, economic issues, education issues. And it may well be that those kinds of things will have an impact upon Judge Cahill as well, as will these other specific things. One of them, once again, going to his use of his position of authority as a law enforcement officer in effect killing a George Floyd. So the answer is yes, all those things can have an impact upon the ultimate sentence imposed here.
Jim Santel, you going to have time one more segment for us?
I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, good, because I got more questions, sir. We heard sound today from the Attorney General of the United States, Merrick Garland, ordering an investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department. And, you know, he talked about this is an investigation, whether or not this is an isolated incident or a broader policy of this police department. Jim, help us understand this concept, and we'll talk more about it on the other side of this break.
Sure. Three things going on here. One, we've got the criminal conviction, which we just talked about under Minnesota law. We also know that there is a pending criminal investigation inside the Civil Rights Division of the same offense conduct, whether whether Chauvin acting under color of law violated George Floyd's constitutional rights. And then this third piece, which is now about whether or not there is a pattern or practice of behaviors inside the Minneapolis Police Department. That's a civil proceeding, lots of history there, which we can, in fact, and should unpack.
And there's some history, similar history, with Milwaukee being investigated.
Absolutely. We had a situation at the end of my term as the United States Attorney involving a process called collaborative reform when Ed Flynn was the police chief, and he did, in fact, agree to that. Similar to this pattern or practice approach that the Attorney General has now rearticulated. You recall also that this is part of the prior administration's 14 of these under the Obama administration, 0 under the Trump administration. And again, I give you more history about all that and how this will work as we go forward here. And as it has gone forward in other cities like like Ferguson, Baltimore, Cleveland.
Come on, James Santel, take us all the way to break. More Devils. We'll be right back.
The Devil's Advocates, radio for the 99%.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. Callers, be patient. We will get to your comments at the top of the hour at 844-967-2789.
Dominic, we've got a fine guest. He's sticking around. Former U.S. Attorney James Santel. Thank you for doing so, Jim. The investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department. These sort of investigations weren't really going on in with any sort of earnest during the Trump administration. You mentioned to us via text, Jeff Sessions. So remind me of the history, Jim, because, you know, our buddy Dominic gets fuzzy sometimes. Yeah. Can't hear Jim.
Absolutely. And so you recall that when Jeff Sessions resigned, he was effectively fired by the former president. You recall that. And that was the news of the day. But just before he left, what he did was he issued a memorandum again before his departure back in 2018, in which he said, you know what, I'm pretty much going to shut down what's called the Special Litigation Section of the Civil Rights Division. These are the folks who, again, historically, you recall, out of Ferguson, the Michael Brown murder there. We got a pattern of practice investigation there. Baltimore, recall Freddie Gray, that situation there prompted the same sort of thing. Tamir Rice in Cleveland, all these cases where under the Obama administration, there had been this effort by the Civil Rights Division Special Litigation to come in and do a top to bottom review of how the police were acting, how they're behaving with the community internally, externally. And Jeff Sessions basically said, we're shutting all of that down. We're going to make it very difficult. You got to get official sign off on it. We're going to put an end date to these kinds of things. He basically abandoned pending cases around the country. And so, as I said before the break, during the Trump administration, under both Barr and Sessions, there were virtually no so-called consent decrees under this process of review and assessment. Under the Obama administration, I'm very proud to say, 14, which again doesn't sound like a huge number, but it underscores the significance of them because of their extensive nature and how very invasive they are, how very time intensive they are. So what happens is Jeff Sessions shuts it all down. We get none of this. And last Friday, before the Chauvin verdict, what does the present attorney general do? He reinstates the prior policy and says, you know, we're going to go back to the future again. We're going to say we're going to reinvigorate. We're going to new this process whereby we are going to have pattern or practice investigations and issues this memorandum to all the U.S. attorneys, all the departments saying we're back in business. We're going to be reviewing once again policing entities. There are 18,000 of them around the country. We're going to be taking a look at those where there may be problems. And as you indicated, in Milwaukee, before the Trump administration, we did have a variation on that called collaborative reform. Ed Flynn did, in fact, agree to have some Department of Justice folks come in. What happened there was that the report was issued, frankly, in draft form. It was leaked to the media, and then administrations changed. And when Jeff Sessions came in, we never saw the light of day of that particular report. But what the significance of today's news is, in the wake of Merrick Garland's rearticulation of this memorandum on Friday before the Chauvin verdict, today he said, I'm now invoking that memorandum. We're going to be instituting a cooperative process, but nonetheless, pattern or practice investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department. It's significant that Medario Arredondo, who is the police chief, who testified so compellingly during the course of the Chauvin trial, that he, in fact, is embracing this. He's supporting it, and we'll see what comes of that investigation. Again, top to bottom, all kinds of things can be reviewed in this pattern or practice process.
Folks, we are the Devil's Advocates. That is James Santel, former U.S. attorney, for about five more minutes. Jim, the initial press release from Minneapolis Police entitled, Man Dies After Medical Incident During Police Interaction. And of course, there's more than just Chauvin involved. And that's why I think this review is certainly very important. And we still have these other officers that are, you know, have some culpability yet to be determined, I guess. If it were not for the video of Darnella Frazier, the 17-year-old, now 18-year-old, and some others who took exception to this abuse, this very well may have been just a medical incident death. as far as the police department was concerned. How many people, Jim, to your understanding, are involved in these kinds of press releases, and how, you know, when it goes from what happened on the ground to what's told to the public, how many hands have to touch something like that?
It should be lots of them, right? Because what has happened? You've had this tragedy of a human being who is dead. And plainly, he's been killed in police custody. He has died in police custody at a minimum. Here, as you indicated, I don't think anybody who will look at this situation and say that but for that video taken by this young witness, this young citizen of our nation, we would not be where we are today. And so getting back to not only the Chauvin verdict, but what's going to happen now with this investigation, the question you just asked, Dom, an excellent one, that's the kind of thing the Department of Justice will ask of people on the ground in Minneapolis. When you issued that, who did you talk to? What was the level of your involvement? And let's make certain that never happens again, because what you said in that press release was plainly, at best, misleading, more likely, more accurately, simply wrong. And so when it comes to internal practices about advising the public of what's going on, basically determining what officers have done, sitting them down, talking through the process, honesty, transparency, clarity in what you do, that's what this process is all about. And so I share completely your concern, not only about what happened here, but about how that should be remedied in the future, not just in Minneapolis, but in any police agency that might be quick to issue. That's why today, as we're seeing again out of Columbus, another shooting, another of a young woman there. We've got the police chief and we've got the mayor basically saying, we don't know all the facts. We're releasing the body camera right away. We're being transparent about this. That I would offer is good policing, even as the facts are not known. That's the kind of thing that should be applauded, depend upon what happens in terms of finding out what factually occurred here. But it's precisely for that reason that this pattern or practice investigation is going to be so important. You also want to take a look at who is the police department recruiting, training issues, all those kinds of things, continued training, supervision, direction. What policies do you have with respect to use of force, discrimination with respect to race and creed and sexual orientation, disability, all those kinds of things. It is a top to bottom analysis. And again, one that I'm very pleased that the police chief is embracing and encouraging inside his own police department with the Department of Justice. They've got the right then to issue this report, either voluntarily complied with. They have a right then to go into court also to seek its enforcement in a federal court to ensure that the things that they recommend do in fact come about.
You're killing me, counselor. I'm chomping at the bit to ask you about yes, collusion. You've got a Mueller report advent calendar. Tell us about the collusion. We got like 1 minute left, Jim.
Sure. And so the issue here is you want to be both separate enough. The Department of Justice wants to come in and be separate enough to be independent and ask those tough questions, but also get access to everything you need to get access to. The documents, the leadership, the police officers, the community has got to be talked to. And so that's where the collaborative part of this comes in. Absent that cooperation, the process does not work. And you can also run into court and get some enforcement of those kinds of things.
Jim, you didn't hear me. I asked you about the Mueller report, my friend. Appreciate you appearing with us here on the Devil's Advocates. We'll have you back real soon. We'll talk more about collusion. Jim Santel, our fine guest. Thank you so much, sir.
Always a pleasure, gentlemen.
Thanks, Jim.
More Devil's Advocates. We'll be back. Hour two, phone lines open, 844-967-2789.
Will there be a lawsuit? Yeah, probably.